Let's start with what we're actually doing here, because the term research brief gets used loosely. A research brief is a structured summary of available evidence on a specific topic. It is not a clinical recommendation. It is not a practice mandate, and it is not a literature review padded to look more complete than it is. What it does is grade what we know, source every claim it makes, and name the gaps out loud. If a claim is strong, we say so, and we say why. If it's thin, we say that too.
And that framing matters enormously for chaplaincy specifically. This is a field that is constantly being asked to justify its presence in hospitals, in correctional settings, in hospice care. And practitioners are often reaching for evidence that hasn't been examined as rigorously as we'd like to believe. The instinct is understandable. You want to defend your seat at the table. But if we overstate what the research supports, we actually undermine the credibility we're trying to build.
Exactly. So the ground rules for everything we cover, evidence gets graded, strong, emerging, or anecdotal. Claims get sourced. If we can't point to where something comes from, we say so, instead of inventing authority. And gaps get named out loud, not buried at the end in a disclaimer, but treated as real information. What we don't know is data.
One more thing worth naming up front. Nothing here is a diagnosis, a treatment recommendation, or a theological position. When evidence points toward a clinical or psychological need, the job is to refer, not to fill that role ourselves. We'll hold to that throughout. All right, let's get into what the evidence actually shows.
Okay, let's grade the evidence. I want to be explicit about what I mean by tiers because this isn't a gut feel exercise. Strong evidence means multiple well-designed studies, consistent findings across different populations and settings, and results that hold up when other researchers try to replicate them. Emerging means there's a signal, a pattern worth paying attention to, but the studies are fewer, smaller, or methodologically weaker. Anecdotal means it shows up in case reports, clinical observation, or professional consensus, but there's no systematic research backbone yet. Those are the three tiers, and we'll call out which tier we're in as we go.
That framing is actually really useful for practitioners to hear, because a lot of what gets passed around at conferences and in supervision sits in that anecdotal tier, but gets treated like it's strong. So let's start with what's actually solid.
Right. The strongest available claim in spiritual care outcomes research is this. Unmet spiritual needs are consistently associated with poorer quality of life in people facing serious illness. This finding shows up across multiple well-designed studies, it's been replicated in different care settings, and it holds up across different ways of measuring both spiritual need and quality of life. This is not a fringe finding, it's one of the more durable results in the field. Now, I want to be careful here. Association is not causation. The research tells us these things move together. It doesn't prove that addressing spiritual need is what's driving quality of life improvement, though there's evidence pointing in that direction.
And in practice, that distinction matters. What this tells a chaplain is, if you're sitting with someone in a palliative care unit and they're describing feeling disconnected from meaning or cut off from what they believe, that's not a soft concern. The evidence supports taking it seriously as something with real quality of life weight. It doesn't tell the chaplain exactly what to do with it, but it absolutely justifies being in that room.
Exactly. There's also reasonably strong evidence around spiritual well-being as a protective factor against depression and anxiety in seriously ill patients. Several validated instruments, the FACITS-B is one that gets used consistently enough to mention, have been used across multiple studies and show a fairly stable inverse relationship. Higher spiritual well-being correlates with lower rates of depression and anxiety in this population. Again, correlation, not causation, but across multiple studies with different samples, that's a signal worth taking seriously.
For chaplains working in oncology or hospice, this lands directly. It reinforces the case for structured spiritual assessment, not as a box to check, but as a genuine clinical contribution to understanding how a patient is doing. And it underscores why the interdisciplinary team conversation matters. What the chaplain is tracking has measurable overlap with what the psychologist and the social worker are tracking.
Now let's move into the emerging tier, because this is where things get messier and we have to be more careful. there's a growing body of work looking at chaplaincy's effect on family satisfaction in ICU settings, specifically around communication during end-of-life decision-making. Some studies suggest chaplain involvement is associated with improved family satisfaction scores and better quality conversations about goals of care. But the samples are small, the study designs vary, and we're not yet at a point where I'd call this robust. It's a signal. It's worth watching. It's not settled.
What that looks like practically: a chaplain who's facilitating a family meeting in the ICU isn't there because we have ironclad proof that chaplain presence statistically improves outcomes. They're there because the evidence is building, because clinical experience supports it, and because the interdisciplinary team recognizes the value. But the chaplain should be honest with themselves and their team that this is an area where we're still building the case, not cashing it in.
There's also emerging work on chaplaincy interventions in non-hospital settings, correctional facilities, community mental health, disaster response. Some of it is promising, but the research is thinner, the methodologies are harder to compare, and the populations studied are often narrow. I'd put this squarely in emerging territory. There's enough there to justify continued practice and continued research, not enough to make strong claims.
And that's actually an important signal for the field. It tells us where the research investment needs to go. The absence of strong evidence in correctional chaplaincy or disaster response isn't evidence that chaplaincy doesn't work there. It's evidence that we haven't studied it well enough yet.
That's a critical distinction, and I want to flag it explicitly, because conflating absence of evidence with evidence of absence is one of the most common errors in how people talk about this field. Now, the anecdotal tier. A significant portion of what guides day-to-day chaplaincy technique, specific listening approaches, how to structure a spiritual history conversation, how to navigate particular ritual requests, lives here. Not because it's wrong, but because it hasn't been tested systematically. It's drawn from training traditions, supervisor wisdom, case experience. That has value. But we should be honest that it's not evidence-based in the same way.
And for practitioners, that's not a reason for shame. It's a reason for humility and curiosity. Most of what every clinician does in any field has some foothold in anecdote or tradition. The question is whether you know which parts of your practice have that foothold and which parts have something stronger. If you can answer that honestly, you're practicing ethically. If you can't, you might be overclaiming to your patients, to your team, to yourself.
One more thing worth naming. Even within the strong evidence tier, the population studied skew heavily. Most of the well-designed research comes from Christian-majority Western healthcare settings. English-speaking samples, adult patients with cancer or end-of-life diagnoses. The evidence base has real boundaries, and those boundaries don't match the full range of settings where chaplains actually work. That's not a critique of the research that exists. It's a map of what's missing. I want to drill into the methodology now, because saying the evidence is weak in places isn't specific enough to be useful. Let me name the actual problems. First, sample sizes. A lot of the chaplaincy outcomes research we're talking about involves samples of 50, 80, maybe 120 participants. That's not nothing, but it's not enough to draw confident conclusions from, especially when you're trying to generalize to a broad clinical population. Small samples inflate the risk of a finding being a statistical accident rather than a real effect.
And I'd add, it's not just sample size, it's sample selection. Many of these studies recruit participants who were already engaged with chaplaincy services, which means you're looking at people who sought out or were receptive to that kind of care. That's a very different population from someone who declined a chaplain visit or someone who never got offered one.
Exactly right. Which connects to a second major problem, lack of control groups. Randomized controlled designs are difficult in spiritual care research for real reasons. You can't ethically withhold pastoral presence from someone in crisis just to have a comparison group. But the consequence is that we often can't separate the effect of chaplaincy specifically from the effect of general human contact, or time, or the broader care environment. When you read a study that says, patients who received chaplain visits reported higher meaning scores. That's interesting, but we don't know what we're actually measuring.
That's a genuinely hard problem, and I think the field sometimes tries to sidestep it rather than name it. The honest answer is, we know something is happening in those encounters. We don't always know whether the chaplain specifically is the active ingredient, or whether the presence, the listening, the unrushed attention, any trained person offering that, would produce similar results.
Third problem, self-report bias. The majority of outcome measures in this field ask patients or families to rate their own experience, their sense of meaning, their spiritual well-being, their satisfaction. Self-report is a legitimate methodology, but it's vulnerable. People tend to report positively about care they received, especially from someone who spent unhurried time with them, and short follow-up windows compound this. Most studies capture outcomes days or weeks after an intervention. We have almost no data on whether spiritual care effects persist at 6 months, a year, 2 years out.
Let me take it from the representation side now. Because methodological problems are one layer, and representational gaps are another. The research base that exists, even the stronger parts of it, is overwhelmingly drawn from Christian and post-Christian frameworks. The instruments we use to measure spiritual well-being were largely developed in Western Christian contexts. That's not a minor footnote. It means that what we're measuring as spiritual well-being may not map onto how a Buddhist patient, or a Hindu family, or a secular humanist, or an indigenous community member actually experiences meaning, suffering, or peace.
And this creates a measurement validity problem, not just a diversity problem. If your instrument was designed to capture one framework's version of spiritual experience, and you apply it to someone operating in a fundamentally different framework, the data you get may not mean what you think it means. The gap isn't just ethical, it's scientific.
There are also entire care settings that are essentially absent from the research. Correctional chaplaincy serves some of the most spiritually complex and underserved populations in any country, and the research literature on outcomes there is extremely thin. Same with military chaplaincy in non-combat roles, community chaplaincy, school chaplaincy. The evidence base was largely built in acute hospital care, and that's not where most chaplains work, and it's not where most spiritual need lives.
I'd also flag a theoretical dominance issue that doesn't get named often enough. The frameworks that dominate chaplaincy research, meaning-making, dignity therapy, narrative approaches, tend to be individualistic and psychologically oriented. They fit well with Western biomedical models of care. But there are communal, relational, and cosmological frameworks in many traditions where individual meaning-making is not the primary category. Those frameworks are underrepresented in the research, and that's a gap in the theory, not just the data.
Which means when a chaplain working with a West African Christian family, or a Navajo patient, or a practicing Shia Muslim looks at the evidence base and tries to apply it, they're working with a map that wasn't drawn for that territory. The evidence doesn't tell them they're wrong to be there. It just doesn't tell them much at all. And practitioners deserve to know that, rather than discovering it by trial and error with actual patients.
To summarize the cracks honestly, the evidence base for spiritual care has real strengths, but it's built on small samples, weak control conditions, self-report measures, short time horizons, and a population and theoretical base that's much narrower than the field it's supposed to serve. That doesn't make the evidence worthless. It makes it preliminary, and it makes humility non-optional.
So, given all of that, the real strengths and the real cracks, let me try to land this for practitioners. There are three postures I'd name: what you can stand on, what you hold loosely, and what you hand off. Standing on, the association between unmet spiritual need and quality of life is solid enough that a chaplain can walk into an interdisciplinary team meeting and say, with confidence, that spiritual assessment is a legitimate clinical contribution. You're not advocating for a soft add-on. You're pointing to a body of evidence that says this matters for outcomes. That's the first posture: confident, grounded, sourced.
And I want to underline that because practitioners sometimes undersell themselves in those team settings. When the evidence is strong, use it. You don't need to hedge a well-replicated finding. The problem isn't overconfidence about strong evidence, it's overconfidence about weak evidence. Those are different problems requiring different corrections.
Exactly. The second posture, holding loosely, applies to the emerging tier. Chaplain involvement in family satisfaction during ICU end-of-life conversations, chaplaincy in community settings, some of the intervention-specific work. a practitioner can draw on these areas without pretending the evidence is settled. And that actually changes how you present yourself to a family or a team. You're not saying research proves chaplains improve family communication. You're saying there's good reason to believe this kind of support matters here, and I'm here to offer it.
That framing also protects practitioners institutionally. If you overclaim and then a skeptical administrator digs into the actual studies, your credibility takes a hit. But if you've been consistently honest about what the evidence shows and what it doesn't, you're in a much more defensible position, and frankly, a more trustworthy one.
The third posture is where the refer-not-treat principle becomes non-negotiable. When a chaplain is sitting with someone, and what emerges is not primarily a spiritual concern, but a clinical one. Signs of major depression, suicidal ideation, acute grief that's become pathological, medical confusion about a care decision. The job is to name it and route it, not to absorb it. The chaplain is not the container for everything that doesn't fit somewhere else. That's a boundary that protects both the patient and the practitioner.
And this is where evidence actually gives chaplains permission to hand off cleanly. If someone is presenting with what looks like clinical depression, the evidence doesn't support chaplaincy as the primary intervention for that. The evidence supports psychological care. So saying, "I want to make sure you're also connected with someone on the mental health team," isn't a retreat. It's evidence-informed practice. You're not abandoning the person. You're getting them what the evidence says they need.
Now, the harder question, and I think this is what practitioners actually wrestle with, is what do you say when the evidence is thin and the person in front of you needs something right now? Because "I'm not sure the research fully supports this" is not what you lead with at a bedside. So the language I'd suggest is something like, "This is what I can offer. Presence, a conversation about what matters to you, help naming what you're carrying." That's honest. It doesn't overclaim a specific outcome. It doesn't pretend there's a protocol. And it doesn't leave the person feeling like they're a research gap.
That's a real skill. Communicating what you don't know without communicating incompetence. And it applies to interdisciplinary teams too. When a physician asks, "What's the evidence for what you're doing?" the honest answer isn't a defensive list of citations. It's something like, "The evidence for spiritual need affecting quality of life is solid. The evidence for this specific intervention in this specific population is still developing. Here's what I observed with this patient and why I think it matters." That's a credible, honest, and useful answer. Here's the evidence grade, plain and direct. Spiritual care has a solid, replicable evidence base for the association between unmet spiritual need and quality of life in serious illness, and a meaningful but still developing evidence base for chaplaincy and as a specific intervention. That's the honest summary. Strong enough to justify the work, preliminary enough to demand rigor.
And here's what I want practitioners to actually do differently tomorrow. Start doing this. When you walk into an interdisciplinary team meeting, bring the evidence with you. Not defensively, not as a shield, but because you've now got a clear sense of what's solid and what isn't, and you can speak to both. Stop doing this. Stop presenting anecdotal tier practice as if it's evidence-backed. Stop reaching for citations you haven't read or numbers you can't source. That habit quietly erodes your credibility and the field's. If you don't know the evidence behind what you're doing, that's your next continuing education goal, not a secret to keep.
For listeners who want to go further, the Association of Professional Chaplains and the Chaplaincy Innovation Lab both maintain publicly available resources on spiritual care research. The FACITSP and other validated spiritual well-being instruments are accessible and worth understanding, even if you're not running studies yourself. And if you're in a setting where chaplaincy outcomes aren't being tracked at all, that's not someone else's problem to solve.
The field doesn't need more practitioners who are defensive about what we don't know. It needs practitioners who are precise about what we do know, honest about the gaps, and actively working to close them through documentation, through collaboration with researchers, through demanding that your institution treats spiritual care as something worth measuring. The evidence will not build itself. We build it, case by case, with rigor.